Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. Mike Jones has been a fixture in public service in St. Louis for most of his adult life. He's a top aide to St. Louis County Executive Charlie Dooley and a member of the State Board of Education. He's a former St. Louis alderman and was a key advisor to former Mayor Clarence Harmon. In a recent piece in the St. Louis American, he suggested that some of Ferguson's problems are the result of black leaders' failure to lead and what he calls political negligence. He does not exclude himself. Mike Jones joins me in studio to talk about those comments. Dr. Donald Suggs is the publisher and executive editor of the St. Louis American, which, of course, published the Mike Jones commentary. Also with us is Patricia Bynes, the Democratic committee woman for Ferguson Township. Thank you all so much for being with us. Nice to see you.
Thank you.
I'm going to read something from your comments in the American, Mike.
Okay.
My view is the circumstances that created the events that resulted in tragedy of Michael Brown's much too early death can be placed squarely at the feet of black leadership, or should I have said, at the failure of black leadership to fulfill the only moral imperative of leadership, that is protecting and advancing the interest of the people you lead. Why that comment?
Okay. Basically, because it's true. Okay, that is the moral imperative for leadership. Period, and you can see it in nature, and it transfers into us as in human society. And because we're social animals, leadership becomes important, and it would be like you're the shepherd given a flock of 100 sheep, and then one day 40 of them are missing and the wolves ate 25, and you want to say you've been a great shepherd, but the flock has been decimated. So the shepherd is responsible for the flock, just like the leader is ultimately responsible for the condition of the people that you lead. And so if you got questions about the quality of that condition, you have to lay that at the feet of the leadership that were responsible during that tenure.
How do you define leadership in this context? Who are the leaders?
Okay, well, first of all, there are all the people who offer themselves to be up to be in the front of the parade, okay? So we serve in positions of responsibility where the decisions we make on behalf of and they affect other people. So by definition, then, you put yourself in that leadership circle when you assume those kind of roles. Some of them are elected, some of them appointed, some of them are civic, but that's what to me it means to be in a leadership role.
Okay. One other quote here that I'll give you and ask you just to detail it for us. You say, we lost our way before we lost Michael Brown.
Yeah, if you focus on the fact that Saturday afternoon, Michael Brown lost his life, but the circumstances that led to those tragic consequences happened before that. And I know I allude to an article about the makeup of the Ferguson government and the Ferguson Police Department relative to the demographic makeup of the city, and it's for me inconceivable that if the government and its infrastructure was representative of the community, that the incident would have happened or would have played out in the way it played out. So the real question is, why was that power disparity or that representation disparity allowed to exist for so long?
And the answer to that question, do we have one?
You probably can come up with a lot of academic and macro reasons about why things exist, but ultimately people didn't show up for the game. I mean, if you really want to boil it down to something, people didn't show up for the game. And when you don't show up, when you don't get on the bus, you forfeit it. And that's what happened in Ferguson. And I would argue over the last 20, 25 years or so, that has happened in the St. Louis metropolitan area, period.
All right. Let me turn to the others here at the table to get some reaction to what you just said. And I'll turn to Dr. Suggs. Fair assessment from Mike Jones?
Well, yeah, I think Mike raises interesting questions, and I'm looking forward to continuing this conversation, although I do think leadership, African-American leadership, per se, no matter how you define it, does have some limits because you operate inside a context, inside a society where there's some things that don't lend themselves to the actions, or at least they don't respond to the actions of African-American leaders, for instance. I think there's some macroeconomic things that go way beyond what is under control of African-Americans. So if you would contrast St. Louis, for instance, with a more, in quotes, advanced African-American leadership like one sees in Atlanta, you have to start way earlier in the story about how Atlanta, which in the 70s was, as a metropolitan region, was smaller than St. Louis, and now is north of 6 million people. There's some implications that go with that. The kind of economy we had in St. Louis 50 years ago and the economy we have now, our ability to attract and retain not just African Americans but also businesses, the nature of our business community. I mean, back in the day when you had family-owned, directed businesses, it was a different environment in terms of how the African-American leadership could interact with, I guess, the powers that...
Well, if I'm understanding you correctly, and I think I am, you're basically saying that black leadership is hobbled to a certain degree by the white powers?
No, I said there's some restrictions, but I don't think that does not exonerate them from their responsibilities. I agree with Michael totally. And this, may I say this before we go any further, if you don't mind, Don. The St. Louis American, and I think increasingly in Ms. Bynes' generation, the media is extremely important in trying to create a forum where we can have these kinds of discussions, these kinds of ideas. And although Mike says that he's going to pay it away, we just can't. The value of his mind, his ability to reason, and his extraordinary intellectual capacity make him invaluable. Because some of these things, quite frankly, don't lend themselves to easy remedies. And we have here a moment, a propitious moment, I think, and it needs the benefit of the best thinking and informed thinking. And so I think that I hope that media, particularly media that's targeted or at least has some credibility in the African-American community, can serve as a forum for discussion of some of these ideas.
Yeah, that's precisely why we're having this conversation. Yes. We're not here to cast stones or cast aspersions, but this is an opportunity to have those conversations, as people say. And if there are deficiencies or inadequacies or things that can be changed and make positive change, this is the place to start, and this is the time to start, I think. By the way, I just wanted to clarify for everyone, I think it's without doubt that you are a member of the black leadership in this community, as is Mike Jones. We want to be absolutely sure.
I might take exception to that. Others might take exception to that.
A matter of public
but as it were.
All right. Patricia, let me turn to you now. As Dr. Suggs has indicated, you represent a different generation. Mm-hmm. How fortunate for you. how nice. But I think this is important because I'm really interested in what your approach to what you've been hearing mm-hmm. and what your reaction to what you've been hearing is. What are you hearing from these two gentlemen?
I'm hearing that, one, they know the history of the region, and that you have to listen to that because you have to be able to understand how did we get here. So to be able to have conversations with Dr. Suggs and Mike Jones and understanding how did we get here from their viewpoint is extremely important because they've been on the front lines, they've been documenting it. So once we figure out how do we get here, we can clearly look at where we are presently. So what I think that there has been a failure of African-American leadership, but not just African-American leadership, also white leadership as well throughout the region because diversity and inclusion is not just a black issue. It belongs to everyone. Mm-hmm. And when you have, I feel like some of the people in Ferguson that say things are fine, we don't have race issues, they're tone deaf. And that's not going to help the problem. And there are several white people in the community who are like, no, there's a problem. You know, we might not know how to fix it, but at least they can acknowledge that there is a problem. And they can acknowledge that African-Americans have been shut out in places like Ferguson, because this isn't just Ferguson. So what I'm hearing is the history, but I also know that this has to be inclusive and people within the community have to step up.
Is there a generational component here that the young people who are on the streets, and it was primarily a younger crowd mm-hmm. on the streets in Ferguson, are not hearing or not listening to the leadership, which is generally described as being of an other generation, an right. older generation?
There is a disconnect. We speak differently. I think I'm in the middle of between like a Generation X and a Generation Y, and there are even disparities in how we communicate with each other and how we view the world. So I think that people maybe my age or younger feel like the older people don't understand them because they feel criticized by them. I think a lot of it is just out of love because they don't want us to make their same mistakes. And sometimes it doesn't come off as constructive as it possibly could. But older people need to understand that all of us aren't lazy. All of us aren't waiting for a quick fix because none of these answers are a quick fix.
Are the younger leaders, and there are younger leaders, obviously.
Yes.
There are many of them on the streets in Ferguson during the month of
yes.
August. Are they in sync with your generation? Totally. I mean, leadership is leadership.
Right. Leadership is leadership. So I know one thing, people around my age and younger tend to get impatient. They don't understand, well, we can fix this, we can do this, and it's done. And that's not how it works, especially in politics. It's a much slower moving beast. And I think in this day and age, when you can tweet something, Facebook something, microwave something, you think, oh, this is it. This is the answer. And it's not. There's a culture within politics where you have to use your influence, and that can take a while. So some of the things that we are trying to do right now, I don't expect maybe to see the fruits of this for maybe another 30 years for it to really come to fruition, but some people don't have that understanding and that patience.
Yeah. Mike Jones, how do we bridge the gap?
First of all, you don't. As a excuse me, Don, as a product of one of those generations at one time, given my age, and I was, as Patricia was talking, I was thinking that Donald and I have been friends for 45 years. Seriously, since he was a revolutionary dentist driving a Volkswagen, and I was a black college activist. That's how we met and became friends. And it was literally 45 years ago. But first of all, young people should be impatient. They should be pressing mm-hmm. older people out of the way. Now, there's a creative tension between generations that should exist. And in point of fact, I would never support any young leader who was waiting to be anointed by somebody my age.
Right.
The person I want to help is
right.
the one that's coming to kick my butt and take
right.
my seat. Then I'm going to show you how to win that fight because I know you'll be the right person to take my place. But if you're waiting to be handed the seat, you're not going to be very good in it. That's number one.
I agree.
Number two, I want to agree with Donald about the macro issues. And while it might sound contradictory, it's not. There are macro forces that impact how any community has to operate. My criticism is, given those macro issues that you can't control, what has been the black leadership response inside of that context? You can't define the context, but you are in control of your reaction to these things. And that's where I find troubling our collective effort over the last 25 years, particularly when I consider the political community I stepped into as a young man, where black politicians mattered, okay? They helped define public policy at a whole lot of different levels. And at 25 years old, I disagree with all of them. But I could say they mattered. They were a power center. And that's not true today. And by extension, the rest of the black civic leadership is also less influential, less powerful, because politically, the black community, principally in St. Louis County, because that's where most black people live now, mm-hmm. and the county is the center of gravity politically and economically for the region, they don't matter. And if they don't matter, decisions get made around them that impact them.
Aside from the fact, I think there might be a TV series in the Revolutionary Dentist Guns.
Yeah, yeah. That's what my wife would say. Yes. Go ahead. Well, I think any kind of discussion like this, needs more than an hour, quite frankly, Don.
Oh, sure.
Because we have to get into the issues of race, class, and we talk about fragmentation between generations. Fact is, there's great fragmentation inside the African American community itself, mm-hmm. and then of course, which leads to the decisions that my father made as a working class, blue collar worker in a little smoky suburb outside Chicago, versus the decisions I had to make coming along another generation, because there were profound changes in the environment in which I grew up and when my father grew up. My father was a brilliant man with no structure and no expectation. And I feel there are thousands and thousands. Mike and I relate in this way as well because of our fathers. I mean, maybe if I could be considered average or maybe a bit above average in intelligence, my father was a brilliant man. But he had no place to take his brilliance. He had this voracious appetite. He read, but he was trapped with his limited education and with the kind of social structure we had at that time. I grew up in a very different environment, much less gifted, much less diligent, much less focused than my father was. But there were many opportunities available to me that were just not available to him and to most of in his generation. We also were working class, and when you're working class at that time, there wasn't much hope that you were going to move outside those circumstances. So the decisions that I had to make, because I'm the product of, when I came to St. Louis, around very racially connected issues. I went to white institutions all my life. I mean, in early life, integrated institutions, but predominantly white. And then university, white, dental school, white. There were two African Americans. And when I left, I wasn't that pleased about being a dentist. Thank you, Mike. But
I wanted to be an oral surgeon.
My response to that was to try to become an oral surgeon. I had a very prestigious internship in Brooklyn at a major hospital there. But I'd never had a black teacher. So for me, it was extremely important to be in an environment where there was a black teacher. And I saw blacks in charge, I thought, at Homer Phillips Hospital. Homer Phillips Hospital doesn't exist anymore. Mm-hmm. In those days, African-Americans who were at Barnes Hospital, they were in the basement. Mm-hmm. There were no African-Americans who were tenured professors in medicine. At Duke University, you've got two or three positions, very prestigious positions at the medical school, where there are African-Americans who are in charge. That's a very different environment. So much of that talent, unfortunately, is sometimes by circumstance, but sometimes by decision. When they get inside the room, they close the door. Mm-hmm. You've got a large segment of the African-American community. The elite in when I grew up, I came to St. Louis, was a certain group of professionals. That same elite, if you measured it by material success, now is almost entirely coming out of the business community. These are people who are business people. Yeah. And in most cases, not particularly tied to the African-American community per se, because their businesses and their products and their services and their connections are not primarily African-Americans. So that's the good news, bad news about the situation for so-called black leadership.
That kind of brings us back to where we started this with Mike. I think that's essentially what you're saying. I have to take a break now. You just heard from Dr. Donald Suggs, the publisher and executive editor of the St. Louis American. He's with us in studio, as is Patricia Bynes, the Democratic committee woman for Ferguson Township. Mike Jones is with us. He, of course, is one of the top aides to Charlie Dooley, St. Louis County executive. We're talking today about the role of black leadership in this community, particularly in the context of what's been going on in Ferguson for the last several weeks. We'll come back and continue the conversation, and we'd certainly like to get you into it. I hope you know our number by now. It's 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org, or if you'd prefer, send us a tweet at STL on air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Hello again. Welcome back as we continue our conversation on black leadership in St. Louis within the context of what has been happening in Ferguson. My guest in studio, Mike Jones, he wrote a piece in the St. Louis American which was critical of black leadership and the role that it's played not only recently but perhaps for the better part of a generation here. He's with me in studio is Dr. Donald Suggs, who was the executive editor and publisher of the St. Louis American, and Patricia Bynes, also here, Democratic committee woman for the Ferguson Township. Mike, a couple of references have been made to the time when you and Don Suggs got started and got yourself prepared for the battle that was ahead. This is 45 years ago. How is black leadership different today than it was then?
I think a real important part, and I'll say if you take the generation or half a generation ahead of me, somebody Donald's age, so let's make it Bill Clay and I. They were products of the civil rights movement. So they brought that energy, that perspective to politics. So it was about advancement. I'm a product of the student movement, the black power movement. So my politics, as I moved into politics, was shaped by that. And then we had the kind of breakdown of American apartheid and the creation of Cliff Huxtable. And so now we create a whole generation of very successful black professionals who don't have a movement experience. So they interpret the reality of America through their individual lens. And I would argue that Donald and I interpret the reality of America through a collective lens that almost has nothing to do with our individual success, because by and large, based on our individual success, we should never have been activists. Okay, we could have been off doing something else.
Patricia, respond to that.
So I agree. When I grew up, my grandparents, my family owns one of the oldest black funeral homes in the country down in Georgia. My grandparents very active and involved. My parents and aunts very active and involved in the civil rights movement, and they taught us that, and they taught us what they went through, how they were the first to integrate, you know, their schools and the marches and things that they went through. So growing up, I've always been very keen in paying attention to things of injustice, because that was just instilled in me. So I do agree with this collective movement piece, but even the work that you guys have done and have been doing, it still is not complete, because we're at this point where we still have a lot to do. And that's where I think people who are about my age and younger, this is where we come in now.
Do you think in some sense they've let you down?
Absolutely not. They've given us a roadmap. They're fantastic for mentoring. They can show us and tell us what works, what hasn't worked, what they see needs to be done. I don't think that they've let us down at all. If it was up to people who were bigots, we wouldn't even be this far in American history. So they certainly haven't let us down. They've given us a roadmap. Now it's about using their knowledge. If we have the energy, we need to use their knowledge, their experiences, to continue to build on what they've laid the foundation for.
All right. Anyone want to react to that?
Well,
Donald Suggs?
We'll be cautious a little bit. I do very much believe in this whole idea of context. You know, the way they treated syphilis at the beginning of the 20th century is not, I mean, syphilis is almost non-existent today. Infectious diseases are not today what they're not treated in the same way they were treated in the past. So I don't think, but there are some things. This is why the mind of a of the minds of our intellectuals, and in St. Louis, that's there's no better example of that than Michael, for instance, because it gives you the kind of overview that's necessary for you to come up with strategy. And as we see the kind of changes we see in not just in St. Louis or the United States, but in the world today, and to see how the power and the force of ideas. You know, quite frankly, you know, I'm a generation and a half ahead of older than Michael, but literally I was introduced to politics, not in my household, because, you know, that very nature of the way they were brought up. It was with labor organizers. As a son of a blue-collar worker, that's the environment I grew up in. I grew up in an environment with African-Americans from the South, with Eastern European immigrant workers, with Hispanic, Mexican, and Puerto Ricans. So I was very much shaped early in my life by those kinds of experiences. And I do think that I wouldn't try to even insist on Ms. Bynes try to understand or relate to that, except to say there's some things you can't get around. There'll be some shifts and some changes, and you'll have to accommodate those. And if you don't believe that, you ask the people who led the Communist Revolution, Mike. Mm-hmm. In 1978, Dao Xiaoping said, we're going to compete,
right.
Which meant everything he believed in, everything he fought for, everything his comrades died for changed. They had to pivot 180 degrees. And the nature of leadership is quite that. You some things you cannot dictate. This is the appropriate way to respond to the challenges. And that's all I would argue, is not that we cannot make the argument. I don't think there's any innate wisdom in being young or being older, but there are some things you have to keep in mind if you're going to make a difference. And I think that is important for young people to recognize, that they need to have the benefit of understanding how important it is to be aware, informed.
Just to Donald's point, the distinction I would make for Patricia, her generation, anybody listening, is managers play a short game. They are interested in who and when. Leadership is about mid-range game, long-term game. And leadership questions all revolve around what and why. And so I think I tried to make the point in the article about tactical versus strategic. Mm-hmm. And you always fail at leadership when your focus is tactical, because your tactics will always shift. But your strategic objective never changes. So it's by staying focused on a strategic objective and making your tactics, as you were referencing, as Dao Xiaoping said, it doesn't make any difference whether the cat is black or white, just as long as it catches mice. So that's so those are the adjustments that you make to keep the movement on focus.
I wonder, Patricia, if there is a greater degree of impatience today amongst people of your generation as opposed to the previous generation.
I would say yes, because several people my age and younger are like, why are we still dealing with this? How did we get to the point where we're still talking about racism? How did we get to the part where municipalities in St. Louis look like apartheid? How did this happen? And if these are things that have been working on, we need to get rid of this immediately. But it's so ingrained, and you got to figure out how to tackle it on for the long term. But I think the impatience is yes, because it's like, wow, I heard about this, read about this, have family that have gone through this, and we're still at the same point in time.
The fact of the matter is that young black men, and black women too, are being stopped by police and, for having done nothing.
Absolutely.
Exactly the way they were years ago, long before the generation of the two gentlemen here. Go ahead, Michael.
And Patricia, my answer to you on that is you're going to have to read and study, and for you and your generation of listeners, I'm going to refer you to Dr. Franz Fanon. So if you read, who was a black psychologist in the 50s, he's Algerian, he was part of the Algerian Liberation Movement, wrote one of the most profound, three profound books, but the one I would refer your audience to is Black Skin, White Mask. Okay? Mm-hmm. His first one was Studies in the Dying Colonialism. So his take on racism is that racism is a permanent part of a racist culture. Mm-hmm. Now, the question for the object of that racism is not to be dominated by it, but to be able to build a kind of character where you're in constant resistance to. Mm-hmm. So this notion of one day we shall overcome is really a mental crutch. What you really need to have is a mindset that we will forever resist, and in that resistance you find your humanity and your dignity, not in the overcoming of it. Mm-hmm. But that's the difference in accepting the notion of protracted struggle as opposed to immediate relief or success.
We are an instant gratification society.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I'd like to get to the phones. We have a number of people who want to join the conversation. Let's start that part of it with Rodney calling from St. Louis. Rodney, thanks for being with us, and thanks for waiting.
Thank you, Don. I'm a Austin listener, first-time caller.
Great.
I think Mike Jones, my God, this man is hitting the nail on the head all over the place. He should be a carpenter of the civil rights movement. Brothers on point. Dr. Suggs, thank you for keeping American up alive. But I think it's even with Dr. Suggs and the sister too, Patricia, I think some points that are being missing. I try to make this as brief as possible, even though this is a very deep topic, is there is a gap. There is a divide between the generations. I think the older generations of blacks tend to, and this is one of the things I see in the St. Louis American all the time, you tend to, I think blacks in the older generation are glad to be accepted by the white culture, and they've arrived, whereas you know, we could talk about Arnold Donald and his rise to success through Monsanto and now through the Carnival Cruise Line. But what about Raheem Jones, the young man that, not that we glorify the drug trade, but having a sense of entrepreneurship in based on survival, when you can have a young man that starts as a scout and ends up being a dealer that has a nice car and stuff. We don't want to glorify that, but when we our leaders are out of touch with what's going on and we have something like this young man's death to kind of galvanize us to the cause of the black to black people, particularly black men, it really needs to be an eye-opening moment for all brothers, all black men, to look at this thing and to have a show like this to be able to step out on and say something on this platform. I mean, we have young men that are completely hopeless, and we have leaders that, you know, that have the money, that have everything. Well, you have other races like the Jews and even the Arabs that will come back, give to the community, set a person up in business, and then take theirs after they made success. We are the only race that cannot really put glue, because as I was talking to a colleague the other day, and she was stating that, well, maybe if we had our own businesses, well, that's one faction, but if somebody doesn't think like you, then we got to deal with that. So we're divided on so many different issues within the race itself. Forget about white folks and what they're doing to us. That's an important part. But what we do to ourselves by not galvanizing.
Rodney, I think we have the point. We have a time consideration here. Let's get a reaction to the points that you've made. Who would like to respond to?
Well, I mean, he's talking about the St. Louis. I think that I certainly welcome his comments. And I wish we had a chance to discuss this in more depth, because the subject is much more complex than he presents it. It's not as simple as that. I mean, there's a situational, there's a reality that you have to operate inside, and you have to try it. At this point in my life, you want to try to be useful, helpful, and my role is to try to be supportive of anything that's going on in the community that's positive and that's helpful, that moves us in that direction. He doesn't, and I wish I had a chance to talk to him personally, this whole idea between them and us, and I don't think necessarily is an accurate, you know, explanation for what he's upset about. But it just, again, I'd have to repeat what I said earlier. I mean, you can't make some of these points very easily, certainly not in a public forum. But if he wants to at some point get in contact, I'd be happy to continue the conversation with him in a way that I think is more realistic. If he thinks that African Americans in America are going to be able to prevail in opposition to the self-interest of the people who run this country, then he's not being realistic. I mean, people, if we're going to push forward, trust me, it has to be based on the enlightened self-interest of a larger group to some extent. Now, they have to be challenged. They have to be, but St. Louis, and African Americans in Ferguson are not the only people suffering from this.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
I mean, and if you can't make the case for people who are interested for their own reasons, then you're probably not going to move this thing very substantively beyond just these kinds of rhetorical, you know, outbursts.
We have to take a break, but do either of you want to make a reaction?
No,
let's take that break. We'll come back, take more calls, and continue this conversation. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Welcome back to our conversation relating to black leadership in our community today. My guests in studio, Mike Jones, Dr. Donald Suggs, and Patricia Bynes. We'll continue our talk in a moment, but here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. Missouri Governor Jay Nixon and State Treasurer Clint Zweifel will announce details this afternoon of a public-private partnership to help businesses in the Ferguson area that were damaged during the destruction following the shooting death of Michael Brown. Lawyers representing some of the protesters from Ferguson are filing a multi-million-dollar lawsuit today against St. Louis County and the City of Ferguson Police Departments. They're seeking damages and compensation for, quote, victims of excessive force, false arrest, and other constitutional rights violations. And a reminder that from 6 to 8 tonight at Wellspring Church in Ferguson, St. Louis Public Radio is hosting Ferguson and Beyond, a community conversation. The discussion is moderated by NPR's Michelle Martin. The event is free and open to the public. Doors will open at 5 o'clock, and seating is on a first-come, first-served basis. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at sdlpublicradio.org. Now back to our conversation. I'd like to bring in David calling from Shiloh in Illinois to start this segment. David, thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Yes, my comment concerning the systemic failure of leadership with black institutions, which includes but are not limited to the NAACP in particular and other civil rights organizations that supposedly were ordained for the purposes of advancing civil rights of blacks and other minorities. It appears to me that this organization, while giving out image awards, needs to clean up its own image. I can recall about 25 years ago when I was working for a bus station before that dome was downtown St. Louis, that policemen would systematically single out black travelers or people who were waiting on folks to come in from out of town. And quite often they would take them to a specific office and would rough them up, and we had several people, including myself, who called the NAACP at that time, and Margaret Bush Wilson was in charge of that so-called legal defense fund, and we reported it. We had dialogue, many of the incidents, officers' names, all of these things, victims' names. We had to call the NAACP several times to even get a comment from them. And finally, the question they asked was, aren't you afraid of losing your job? It wasn't concerned about what was going on.
David, let us get a response to your main point here regarding what I think you said was the failure of organizations such as this. Mike Jones, what do you think? Has there been a failure? Is that the right word?
Well, I'm going to separate two things. On a day-to-day basis, everybody fails and makes mistakes. I got a metaphor that said everybody misses more shots than they make, even the best shooters in the game.
You're into the sports metaphor,
right?
Today,
so the fact that on any given day somebody blows a call, blows a shot, doesn't concern me. What my concern with the leadership issue is not these tactical issues, but the inability to make those strategic adjustments. Mm-hmm. To the macro forces that Donald was referencing earlier. Because when you successfully do that, then staying with my sports metaphor, you create a game plan that your players can make plays in because you've given them the right direction. And the leadership failure is the strategic adjustment, not what happened that they didn't do on a certain day in a certain time. Because in the course of human events, there's going to be a ton of those. Yeah. Our problem is the strategic imbalance between the black community and the white community from a political power and economic power standpoint inside the existing framework.
Yeah. Patricia, I want to get your take on this because, again, you're of a younger generation, a different generation. Your take on the failure of organizations like this, and I use that word because he used it.
I guess it depends on what you think failure is. No one organization, group, or leader is going to solve these problems. They are continuous, and this is an ongoing issue. So I think what happened is some advances were made in the civil rights movement and people got comfortable. They got better homes. They got better incomes. They got into better schools and they took a breath. But while they were breathing, there were other people on the other side saying, oh, no. Oh, no. We've got to move the pendulum the other way. And while everybody got comfortable, this is how we got to where we are now. So it's time to get uncomfortable, because when you get in something like this, you have to understand you are in this, because there is another force, like Mike talked about on the other side, that is continuous. And every two steps you take, they're trying to plan 10 more on the other side.
And, of course, the incident that the gentleman referred to is an incident that is taking place today and is one of the big things that was mentioned and talked about so much during the time of the Ferguson Troubles. Right. Young men being stopped for no reason at all.
Exactly.
And being hassled and, in some cases, roughed up.
Right.
Donald Suggs, any thought do you have with regard to his comment? On
Well, I mean, the more the conversation proceeds, the more it's difficult to comment. Because we're taking like just little snapshots of something
sure.
that's really has a much larger view. It's almost like looking at the situation from the basement and as opposed to from the penthouse. And some of this is getting so very narrow in its in its concern that it gets away from what I think the really large issues are that have been going on in this country for the last 300 years. And so you take race, class, and then you take the current. The way this country is organized, the way the world is organized. I mean, just I don't think things that we thought were appropriate, 50 years ago, we recognize that those are futile. That's the point I made about Dao Xiaoping. I mean, you couldn't convince anybody in 1945 or 1955 or 1965 that this is going to be the way, the direction of China. So I think that when you have these kind of conversations that tend to focus, as Michael said earlier, about tactical things, you're going to have to be able, at somebody in the organization has to have the benefit of understanding the backstory. If you don't do that, you're going to be, whatever your passion is, if you don't find a way to channel that, given the realities that you're confronted with, every strategy that we talk about is not appropriate for every situation. So you have to be in that sense. You have to understand, Mike uses sports metaphors. It depends on who's on your bench, right. Whether you use the bench or not. So some of these things that young people talk about, I think it's so appropriate that they feel as they do and that they resist the idea of accepting so-called old folks. But there's some things, young, old, whoever you are, if you don't keep in mind some of the realities that you're faced with, every noble cause does not come out to a good ending. Just because you have the moral authority doesn't mean you're going to win.
Right. Being right and $5 will get you a latte at Starbucks, okay?
Right.
And that's what people really need. Ultimately, you're always trying to affect the power equation.
Mm-hmm.
And then figure out how to leverage your power to maximum advantage. Now, it's great if you got the moral high ground. But it's even better if you got power. So
mm-hmm.
if you can marry those two things, because the moral high ground and no leverage gets you zero.
Yep.
Isn't this where leadership comes in, however? I mean,
that is what leadership mm-hmm. is about. That was my point at the beginning. It's all right for I think it's in Proverbs. It says where the leaders have no vision, the people will perish.
Well,
it didn't say where the people didn't have vision.
Right. Who are today's leaders in the black world?
Well, first of all, we have, black Americans are subject to the same idiotic pop culture as white Americans, okay? So with 150 channels and tweet and Facebook, we've confused celebrity mm-hmm. and notoriety with leadership.
Yes.
So you got every idiot with a quote can get on the radio or be on television because somebody's got to be on all these channels.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a time that leadership was a function of, one, your intellect, two, your ability to organize and sustain a movement or an effort over an extended period of time. And we now have an instant society that doesn't do that. So it makes it hard to identify leadership, and it makes it hard for nascent leadership to sustain itself
till it matures to the point where it can lead.
But, you know, I think blacks and whites can recognize some of these people for what they are. And I'll throw out the name of Al Sharpton. He shows up at events and white people say, here's Al Sharpton once again. He comes in whenever there's a problem. Is he doing any good?
I'll take exception to that. Yeah. I don't mean, certainly he's not a perfect warrior, as it were. But Al Sharpton represents certain things in the African-American community. And that's why these conversations are very important. I don't know how he appears to you, and I don't. And I would say to you that before you dismiss him, he, in many ways, has his hand on the sensibility and the pulse, and he has been out here protesting some of these excesses around the police for years.
Decades.
And has he been perfect? No, he has not. Can I say to you he's a perfect leader? No, he is not. However, he represents some deeply felt feelings in the African-American community. And let me just say also that some of the things we're talking about here, they really go straight to the structural issues where our society is organized, and that's just the way it works in the United States and maybe in the world. But I think to simply take the cheap shot at – I mean, it's not a cheap shot, Don, but to simply dismiss an Al Sharpton because he has not been – his press has not reflected the kind of person you think a leader ought to be.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you this, that a lot of what has happened, and this is notwithstanding the young people and their rage, I think justifiable rage, and I give them all the credit for that energy they bring to it. But Al Sharpton, through his years, brings a certain kind of understanding, a certain kind of perspective, and he, in my view, I don't think he's the answer. I don't think he's the solution. But just simply dismiss his contributions, I think, is not fair and not accurate.
Yeah. I would also add that I think it's important. Al Sharpton did not just show up here in St. Louis. His the family, Mike Brown's family, reached out to him and asked him to come. So I disagree when people think, oh, he just showed up. No, he was asked to come here. And I think he served a very good purpose in helping this family and this community as far as addressing what the issues were and bringing them some resources that were not here before. So I'm not one to knock Al Sharpton, even though I'm young. I have a lot of respect for him. He's been out on the front lines. Nobody's perfect. But he is a very strong voice, especially for the issues that we're dealing with now.
I want to obviously concur with Donald and Patricia. And the white response to Al Sharpton, if you started to look, and not just Al Sharpton, if you looked at some of the white commentary or comments to the commentary, you would have thought you were in Birmingham in 1965. Because if you listen to Southern whites, the whole civil rights movement was about outside agitators, and our Negroes are all real happy. And if it wasn't for the outside agitators, we wouldn't have a problem. Now, you ratchet this up to 2014 language. And if you're black, that's the same context. So with a longer historical perspective, you understand that the reaction to black protests about that racial injustice sounds exactly like the white reaction to the black protests of this racial injustice. So we all are looking through the context or the lens of our historical experience. And historical in a way, let's be clear. From a biological standpoint, race doesn't exist. I mean, there's just one human species. But race is a social construct that has political and economic consequences so that the world is organized, at least America is organized around that construct. And my response when I hear whites say, well, blacks ought to get past race, I could say when white folks give up white, we can afford to give up black.
Right.
Okay,
right.
I mean, and it's really not much more complicated than that. So you give up white, I can't give up black because I can't afford to be disarmed in this contest for resources.
There is so much to talk about in so little time, as Donald Suggs has said. Just we can't do it all in an hour. But we do have a minute left, and Mike, I'll give you this because it comes from your article. You said to the young people today, be leaders. How do they do that?
Well, I mean, you got to own the moment, okay? Don't worry about the odds. Don't worry about prevailing. You have to a quick story, but
the punchline
of it is, when I was growing up, you used to have to wait for the big boys before the game could start. And a good friend of mine one day said, we can start playing anytime we want because we're the big boys. And I guess what I'm saying, I'm asking this generation to recognize you don't have to wait to be authorized, be self-authorizers.
We've got to stop it right there. It's a good spot in which to stop. Yeah. Mike Jones, thank you so much for being with us, and thank you for the article. It's food for thought and something worth discussing, obviously. Patricia Bynes, thank you for being with us. Great to see you. And Donald Suggs, always good to see you. Thank you for being with us. Tomorrow, Cityscape will be preempted as we broadcast tonight's community conversation in Ferguson, moderated by NPR's Michelle Martin. You can also join the audience tonight at 6 at Wellspring Church in downtown Ferguson. Doors open at 5. More information on our website. Monday on St. Louis on the Air, we'll have a holiday rebroadcast of our conversation with Dave Barry about his recent book. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. This program is produced by Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer, with production assistance from Erica Smith, Aaron Dorr, Amanda Hunningfort, and Spencer Reed. Executive producers Robert Peterson. And today we say thank you and goodbye to intern Amanda Hunningfort, who has served so nobly since the beginning of the year. We wish her well as she goes to Washington, D.C. for an internship with NPR's TED Radio Hour. Thank you all so much for being with us. I'm Don Marsh.